Welcome on Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. You've heard of California's rainy day fund, that cash reserve. Well, not long ago, the state used to have a rainy day stash of emergency medical supplies until we didn't. We'll hear what happened to it. Plus, it's tough to date when you can't meet up or go anywhere. But if you have the will, we have the ways to at least get the dating ball rolling in the age of coronavirus. It's all coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I mean, Martinez, TGIFWFH, if you're working from home, right? Now, well, you're already home, so. All right, thanks for joining us today. Let's dive right in with State of Affairs. It's our weekly deep dive on politics in California. And this week, what happened to California's once massive cache of medical supplies? Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi pushes for oversight as the federal government shells out trillions to keep the economy afloat. We'll get into those stories and more with Carla Marinucci. She's senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Welcome back, Carla. You there,
hey,
Carla?
Hey, oh,
there you are. There you are. All right. Zach Corser is also with us. He co-directs the policy lab at Claremont McKenna College. Gotcha, Carla. I think there might be a slight delay, so we'll try to work with that as best as possible. So, Carla, let's start with you. California once had a huge stash of medical supplies for a moment, just like the one we're going through right now. But sadly, the key word is had. You talked to the person behind the stash this week, and that's former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. First off, why did he decide to stockpile supplies?
It's interesting that Schwarzenegger, who of course is a lifelong proponent of fitness, this is a guy who's a famous bodybuilder, he told me that he obsessed as governor about the idea that California be ready with medical supplies.
Hey, Carla, let's hold on. We're going to work on your connection and try and make it a little bit better. Zach Corser, co-directs the policy lab at Claremont McKenna College. Jump in here for Carla because, yeah, I remember back, 2011, Zach? It was when Arnold Schwarzenegger, or at least that's when the stash kind of started to go away.
Well, yeah. So Governor Schwarzenegger had set aside $200 million to create a preparedness program for pandemics in relation to the avian flu and a prediction that there could be more ahead. And, you know, remembering back to 2008, there was a massive hole in the California budget that was driven by the Great Recession. And, you know, Jerry Brown was there to cut back. And I think what we saw, perhaps, is something of a little bit of a monomania about cuts, where even though it was relatively little to support this $200 million investment, somewhere in the range of, you know, $5 million to support mobile hospitals, ventilators, masks, N95 masks, you know, sort of the whole infrastructure that you would need at a moment like this, Brown decided to cut it. And I think what's interesting about it, one, is it is sort of a reflection of short-term emergency thinking in the depths of a budget crisis. But the other thing, too, was that there really wasn't a strong interest on the other side of this. That is to say, doctors, hospitals, you know, some kind of organized group within California who was sort of crying out to say, we have to hold on to this.
Yeah.
You know, there were a few people inside the administration of the state administration that were trying to keep this going. But ultimately, it sort of failed for the lack of an outcry to keep this going.
Now, Carla, let's go back to you for a second. I was saying how you spoke with former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger about why he decided to even stockpile the supplies when he did.
Yeah, I mean, he was a fitness proponent lifelong, and he
Arnold
told
me, really?
Yes,
he liked to work out.
Oh. And, you know, that kind of played into it. He said he was obsessed as governor with the idea that California be ready in case of a medical emergency, a major emergency, not just a pandemic. He was talking about, you know, a major earthquake, for instance. And so he thought it was a modest investment, about $200 million. He put it into these mobile hospitals. There were two mobile hospitals, even helicopters, all the kinds of equipment California would need in the event of a major emergency. And he said, look, that the budget should have come second to saving people's lives in that case. And he thought it was short-sighted, is the way he put it, when the budget gurus eventually had their red pens out. And it looks like California may now be paying the price for that. It was scrapped. The hospitals were never used. And now we know what happened.
So then what was his take, Schwarzenegger's take, on what Jerry Brown decided to do?
You know, I pressed him on Jerry Brown, and Schwarzenegger just refuses to throw Jerry Brown under the bus on this. He says he prefers not to judge, you know, the decisions made in the past. He says every governor's got to make his own decisions. Remember, as Zach said, the budget crisis coming out of recession and all. But the fact is, he's one of the Californians, I think, who are basically saying they've got to do their own actions to make this better now. I mean, when I FaceTimed with him this week, he was personally unloading 50,000 masks for hospitals in Los Angeles. He started a GoFundMe, and he's already, I think, got more than $5 million going on that front. So he's out there working with California firms to try and get the equipment, and that's the status of it right now. He will not criticize Jerry Brown, though.
Zach, you know, I don't know if I have that kind of memory to go back to 2011, and it's not that long ago, but the program would have cost so little to maintain. I mean, ultimately, was it just something that Jerry Brown felt that he could just live without completely?
Well, I mean, certainly in hindsight, this does seem to be, you know, penny wise and pound foolish in the sense that, yeah, a huge initial investment had already been made by Schwarzenegger on the score of $200 million. And so if we're talking $6 million a year to hold on to this in a budget of $129 billion, it doesn't even seem to be a ripple in the pond. But again, you know, hindsight's 20/20. Yeah. I think at the time, the idea was that this just didn't seem realistic. A lot of the questions that were being asked within the Brown administration were basically, have we ever used any of this stuff? And the answer, of course, was no. Nothing had occurred that would call on these kinds of reserves. And it's hard to make long-term emergency planning kinds of decisions when you're in the depth of a budget crisis. But nonetheless, had that been here today, California would be in much better shape dealing with this crisis.
And Carla, Schwarzenegger's stash had about, what, 50 million N95 respirators, yeah. 2,400 portable ventilators and kits to set up, what, 21,000 additional patient beds. What happened to that stockpile? Where is it?
Well, the state of the stockpile today is nowhere near that. I mean, the governor, Governor Gavin Newsom, in his briefing today basically described a continuing battle for California to procure what it needs. I mean, he's had to direct about $42 million in emergency funding to try and get some of this stuff together. He's got $30 million for two hospitals that are going to provide a couple thousand beds in this. But the fact is, I mean, California has now requested about 20 million of those N95 masks. And some of the material that it's gotten from the federal stockpile, this is kind of the real capper, has been not working or even expired. I mean, he talked about getting 172 ventilators that didn't work from that federal stockpile. He had to send them to Bloom Energy in Silicon Valley. Wow. He's tried to procure them from Elon Musk, who's come up with 1,000. And, you know, earlier this month, the Public Health Department announced it had gotten, I think, 21 million masks, but they were beyond their expiration date. So the fact is, California is not in as good shape nearly, and is now gone begging for a lot of this material. Newsom says California is in much better shape than many other states, though, because it has more buying power to be able to do that now.
And Zach, on that point, I mean, it just seems like states right now, it's like the Wild Wild West, a bidding war, every state for themselves in a way. I mean, in times like this, is a federal distribution plan maybe a better plan? Maybe that's what's really needed now. Or are we past that, really?
I don't know that we're past it, but I think that's absolutely right. What we're experiencing is a market failure when it comes to PPE gear and respirators. And the government is supposed to step in and help correct market failures. You know, if there's not enough supply, they've got to help with that demand. And it's obviously the goal of the federal government to coordinate these kinds of things. But I think what we're also experiencing is a kind of government failure, where there are many, many tools that are at the president's disposal to do things within the economy. I mean, you think back to the 70s, where President Nixon put a price control. He froze wages and prices for 90 days just to combat inflation. I mean, there's a lot of things a president could do. But I think he's being held back by his advisors, who are basically saying, hands off the free market. We shouldn't get in the way of industry. You know, this is an opportunity for the market to prove itself. But even that kind of fails in this kind of reaction to circumstances. Right now, the administration is trying to stop 3M from exporting any more N95 masks. And 3M is saying, well, that doesn't make any sense. We have an integrated supply chain. We actually manufacture these things in China. We get our materials to make things like ventilators from around the world. And if we basically say to other countries, we won't help you with your emergency supplies, they're going to cut us off as well. So I don't know. Again, it's a government failure. It's a reaction. I don't think anything is thought through. We need a plan. People need to think ahead in order to be able to meet this crisis.
So Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Also, Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Now, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced this week that she'd form a bipartisan committee to oversee the Trump administration's response to the outbreak, and that includes that $2 trillion stimulus. Carla, what is she proposing, and how has the Trump administration reacted?
Well, you know, the key word here is oversight, and that's what Speaker Pelosi is advocating. And she's pushing for this bipartisan panel of lawmakers to make sure those trillions that are allocated by Congress are going to go where they're supposed to, that they stimulate the economy instead of stimulating the bank accounts of specific individuals or specific companies. And she told reporters on a conference call this week that the aim of the panel is to basically weed out fraud, abuse, to protect against price gouging, profiteering, and so forth. But even in, you know, these times that we're in, her statements have kind of rankled some Republicans, and they dramatize, you know, this partisanship thing has not disappeared here. Because when Trump signed that $2 trillion coronavirus relief bill, he bridled at the oversight provisions imposed by Congress. He said they proposed constitutional concerns to the executive branch. So what we're looking at now is, you know, Pelosi's call for the House Select Committee, is facing pushback from Republicans, including Trump. He has accused Pelosi of trying to play politics during the global health crisis. And bottom line is, I mean, this could spill over into more bickering as the Speaker and the Democrats. They're pushing for a fourth emergency aid bill going forward with unemployment skyrocketing. So, I mean, let's see how this plays out. It's not looking good.
Yeah, Zach, I mean, this is $2 trillion, not $2 billion, not $2 million. It's $2 trillion. So it just sounds like a lot of money to have out there without at least some oversight. Is there a risk, Zach, that the country's recovery efforts could get all wrapped up in more partisan bickering?
I think that's a constant risk. In fact, I think, you know, the CARES Act, the sort of phase three relief bill that came out, I mean, if anything, it barely sublimated the deep partisan divides within Congress and within the country. And they've not gone away. You can remember that there were some objections being raised by South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham about unemployment, for example, and he ended up getting a vote on it. But it was sort of outrageous at the time where everyone was in a hurry to get this through because we're such a major concern about, you know, 20% unemployment and the market's failing. And yet partisanship was still sort of slowing this down. So if things get better, so to speak, I mean, we're not out of the woods. We're just sort of slowed down the crisis. I think partisanship is ready and willing to rear its head and slow these things down.
Well, one more thing before we wrap up. I know state governors have gotten a lot of attention for their response to the outbreak. A new piece in Politico makes a case that there are signs that they may be reshaping the party's pipeline of prospective presidential candidates for years to come. Carla, right now, who's standing out in terms of governors?
Well, as you know, there's no question that Gavin Newsom has gotten national attention in this arena. He was on The View today. He's on The Daily Show this week. And not just because he's the head of the world's fifth largest economy. Look, he's been a vanguard on this. He ordered seniors to stay at home first. He ordered the entire population of the state to shelter in place before anyone else. He's getting credit for flattening the curve here. But I think you got to watch Andrew Cuomo, too. While Newsom is doing these daily briefings, a very CEO, kind of Silicon Valley style, Andrew Cuomo's got this New York Italian coffee with Cuomo thing going on.
Coffee with Cuomo.
That has given him sort of a national profile. You've even got sort of draft Cuomo feeds out there. I think that this has all put focus on governors being the doers in this thing, and a lot of them are becoming figures for a whole audience that never knew they existed before.
And one thing really quick, Zach, a state response to COVID-19 has not been uniform. Politico ranked the best and worst state leaders right now. A Republican from Ohio, actually, Mike DeWine, topped the list of the best, but the bottom six were almost all Republicans. Why has Republican response lagged in this area, and how are they paying for it now?
Well, I think, you know, probably the number one on that list is Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, who has stayed very closely to the company line that's being put out by the Trump administration, has actually been in some ways slower to respond than the Trump administration because of a perceived red-blue divide on whether COVID was the flu or whether it was a serious pandemic. And I think, you know, we haven't talked about elections here in a while because we're dealing with the pandemic, but I think Florida's a state to watch. There was an article in Politico this morning talking about the reaction, the negative reaction in Florida to the handling of this pandemic situation. And if Florida doesn't come through for Trump this November, I don't know that he's really got a path to victory. So, I mean, Florida, you know, this starts out with lives and response and a measurement of the capabilities of these governors to meet this crisis. But I think there's going to be big political consequences coming in November.
Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Carla Marinucci is senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Carla, Zach, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Stay safe, guys.
All right, every day that goes by, news and information about the coronavirus pandemic changes, and that means you got a lot of questions about some pretty basic things. Luckily, we have an expert with all the answers. Stay tuned when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
I see the crystal raindrops fall, and the beauty of it all is when the sun comes shining through. To make those rainbows in my mind when I think of you sometime, and I want to spend some time with you. Just the two of us, we can make it if we try. Just the two of us,
just the two of us,
just the two of us, building castles.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. That, of course, the great Bill Withers. We got word this morning that he passed away on Monday at the age of 81 due to heart complications. He was a prolific singer-songwriter whose credits include many songs most of us know by heart, like Just the Two of Us. That's the one you're hearing right now. Lovely Day, Lean on Me. The artist Questlove was quoted as saying, Bill Withers is the closest thing black people have to a Bruce Springsteen. He moved to Los Angeles after serving in the military and struck it big as an artist in the 70s. And the funny thing is, he left music completely in the mid-80s, despite his success, only making an appearance here and there to accept an award or to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Plenty of musicians have covered his music in the last 35 years, however, and no doubt that many more will continue to do so as long as there is music. All right, now, as we move into our third week of staying at home and continue to adjust to the new rhythm of our lives, your questions about the coronavirus and COVID-19 have not slowed down, so we're going to take some time to answer them. Dr. Robert Kim Farley is here to help us with that. He's with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health, a former staffer with the Centers for Disease Control. Doctor, welcome back.
It's good to be back, eh?
All right. Now, there's been a lot of news surrounding masks lately. On Wednesday, Mayor Eric Garcetti urged citizens, even those without symptoms, to wear masks when going out to do essential tasks like going to the grocery store. Doctor, we've spoken with you throughout the weeks about this. So where does the CDC currently stand on face coverings?
So, I think you bring up a good point that this has been evolving, and I think that's one thing that maybe your listenership sometimes can cause confusion. The CDC guidance actually is anticipated, almost like we are speaking, it is anticipated that they're going to come out with guidance that people should, when they're outside, be wearing masks, cloth masks, not the healthcare mask, because we have short supply of those. But I think the concern is that people still recognize that, you know, you really shouldn't be going out unless it's an essential task to go out, or if you're going out of doors to walk. But even if you do, be sure you keep that 6-foot physical distancing. The masks would not be, or face coverings would not be, a substitute for that. So I think we're going to have to be keeping tuned in about this. The main reason is this guidance is changing is the concern about the fact that asymptomatic transmission, people that do not have symptoms, may be causing some of the transmission occurring. And so this would be a way of making sure that you are protecting other people. And in a sense, by everyone else wearing masks, they're protecting you. So it's everyone kind of working together on this.
And to that point, that mask is not a force field of any kind. You're still susceptible, maybe, if something goes wrong. It's not like it's a bubble that will keep you away from everything. So let's dig into our first listener question. This one comes from an anonymous user who writes, is there any guidance for masks and people who walk for exercise? I live in Chatsworth, so more wide open spaces, easy to keep 6 feet or more. So if I'm out in public, but I'm not in a store, do I need a mask in that case if I'm walking all alone?
So obviously, if you have symptoms, you obviously need to be outside with a mask. You shouldn't even be outside unless you're going to your doctor's office after you've called him first. But I think the thing is now with Mayor Garcetti's request that basically we all should be wearing masks when we're out of doors, I think the issue now is just trying to be a good citizen and being able to model that behavior. So, yes, logically, in the sense if you're out of doors, no one is around you, but, you know, someone could be coming up from behind you, yeah, that you might not recognize, things like this. So I think the idea is that if we all are starting that behavior, then I think everyone will feel more safe.
I always wondered why, Doctor. Those masks are so easy to carry in your pockets. Why not just have it all the time?
Yeah.
All right, so now we know that a mask is essential for people who are caring for the sick, even in a home environment. What other advice do you have for someone in this situation? I mean, how can they best protect themselves and other people in that household?
Yeah, so when you're actually caring for someone who has COVID-19, knows they have not gotten ill enough to actually have to go to the hospital, I think the first thing that you need to realize is that you need to be kind of monitoring them to make sure that if they start having trouble breathing or, you know, persistent pain or pressure in the chest, things like this, you need to make sure that you're calling their health care provider to say that, hey, look, this person is experiencing some more severe symptoms, especially if they're elderly or if they had pre-existing conditions. You are correct that other things that you can do if you're caring for the person, you could be wearing a mask. Make sure that person, if you're entering their room, is wearing a mask because they're symptomatic. Cleaning frequently the surfaces, trying to keep that person who is ill using just the one bedroom, ideally just one bathroom as well. And laundry is okay, but you shouldn't be shaking the laundry before putting it into the machine. That sort of thing, so you're not, you know, aerosolizing these virus particles that may be on their laundry. I think the important thing is, again, just making sure that any unnecessary visitors are restricted, washing your hands frequently if you are caring for someone with COVID-19.
Talking to Dr. Robert Kim Farley with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. We've been getting a lot of different versions of the same question. None more popular, Doctor, than those regarding the grocery store. And this one comes from Maru Pomerantz, and she wants to know about farmers markets. Some are still gathering in Santa Monica, and she asks, is this safe? Should they be closed or open to the public?
Yes, that's a very good question from Maru. Basically, the farmers markets were temporarily closed, but you'll be seeing that several of them are now being given the authority to reopen. Santa Monica, for example, is one. And but they have to submit a plan for physical distancing and also having hand sanitizers available within the market. So the farmers markets are gearing up to that same situation as you should be finding in grocery stores now, where limited numbers of people coming in, making sure that people have physical distancing when they're standing in line to purchase, these sorts of things. So with that, then, farmers markets are beginning to reopen.
One note about the markets. One anonymous listener asked, I'm wearing latex gloves when I leave the store and use hand sanitizer or wash my latex hands. Are they okay to keep wearing? So what's that best practice when it comes to those gloves?
So again, the main thing, of course, when you've left marketplace and you're touching things, is to wash your hands. So she's talking about if she's wearing gloves in addition to that, washing these gloves. Probably the best thing to do would be to have some of these small plastic disposable gloves, not healthcare type of gloves that you would use for caring for someone or healthcare workers are using. That would be like more like the latex gloves, but, you know, plastic gloves for food handling. And you just dispose of those. That's probably the easiest thing to do.
Okay. And in the midst of a pandemic, life definitely has to go on. And we've gotten a few listener questions, Doctor, about moving. One anonymous listener finds themselves in a very tricky situation. Their roommate is planning on leaving, so they ask, any advice or resources on apartment hunting and moving? I'm just so confused on the stay-at-home rules and restrictions currently in place.
Well, I think a number of things. One is that, you know, thanks again to technology, really one can actually online view most accommodations that they are searching for and hunting for apartments and rooms, Airbnb, that sort of thing, so that you can actually see this place. Hey, is this something that I really would be interested in? So you already could limit then the number of places you would visit, which I think is important. And then when you do visit a place to see if you wish to make a contract for living there, making sure, again, that you stay physically distant. And when you've exited the place, wash your hands again. So I think that's what you would do in this era.
Dr. Robert Kim Farley is with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health, also former staffer with the Centers for Disease Control. Doctor, thank you once again for your patience and time with all of these questions.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to be on your program, and I appreciate you trying to give your listenership the right information and the facts.
Now to San Bernardino County. Health officials there are monitoring a cluster of COVID-19 infections at a Yucaipa nursing home. So far, two residents have died at the facility. KPCC reporter Robert Garova has been looking into what can be done in situations just like this, where extremely vulnerable populations are faced with an outbreak in close quarters. Robert, welcome back to Take Two.
Hey.
Now, what do we know about what's going on at this nursing home in Yucaipa?
So far, 51 residents and 6 staff members have tested positive for the new coronavirus. This is at a place called Cedar Mountain Nursing Home. I spoke with a woman named Deborah Hoffman. She's got a family member at the facility. She said her 75-year-old aunt told her she's been asked to keep to her room. Neither of them, though, are happy about communication from the facility about what's going on.
The hardest thing is that I can't physically go up there and control this situation. I can't go in to see what's really going on, and I'm not getting accurate information.
Now, Hoffman said the facility has been on lockdown, so she hasn't been able to visit her aunt, who suffered a stroke. She also needs full-time care. She said it's not clear whether or not her aunt has been tested. A spokesperson with the county told me Wednesday that most people have been tested, but not all. But they're assuming at this point that the whole facility has been exposed.
What about the response from the state or local public health officials? I mean, what could be done in a situation like this?
Yeah, so the California Department of Public Health says it sent infection control specialists to the facility. Cedar Mountain hasn't returned a request for comment, so we don't know exactly what's going on there. But we do know what the state says they should be doing at a skilled nursing facility like this. For one, symptomatic residents and exposed roommates are supposed to limit movement outside their room. That kind of squares with what we were hearing from Deborah earlier. If they do leave the room, they're supposed to wear a face mask. As far as preventing the spread of the virus, the state's guidelines say residents with confirmed or suspected COVID-19 infection should be kept in the same wing or the same building, and the communal dining area should be closed. They also say high-touch surfaces should be cleaned and disinfected. I guess that's kind of self-explanatory, but you're supposed to do that with EPA-registered disinfectants, the state says.
Yeah.
Really, though, these are extremely difficult situations to manage, and nurses and people who run nursing homes are really worried about more clusters like this happening, you know, around the state.
Yeah, of course, it's understandable. You were on a call with some nurses and people who are worried about how prepared nursing homes are for more outbreaks. So what did you hear from them?
So April Verrett is president of a union that represents thousands of nursing home workers. She's really concerned about frontline workers not having the protective equipment. We're talking about masks, gowns, and gloves that they need to keep themselves and their residents safe. Here's what she had to say.
We need millions of masks, millions of gowns, and other safety equipment immediately. And without federal action, I can say with sure certainty, more lives will be lost.
So April said she felt like the outbreaks, like the one we're seeing in Yucaipa, are just the tip of the iceberg. And it's really not just San Bernardino where we're seeing cases in nursing homes. There are a number of nursing homes and skilled facilities in L.A. County where there's at least one confirmed COVID-19 case. L.A.'s top health officials said yesterday that there have already been 11 deaths in those settings.
That's KPCC's Robert Garova. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
We were talking to Dr. Robert Kim Farley earlier about the CDC and masks. Well, now President Trump is announcing that the CDC is recommending voluntary mask and face coverings of some kind. And actually, that White House Coronavirus Task Force daily briefing is happening right now. If you want to hear that, just go to our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. And since it's likely school is out for the spring and summer, we've heard stories about how challenging it is for schools and students to stay on track. Kids at all grade levels not getting the optimum kind of instruction despite our circumstances, special ed kids, it's even worse. Find out how when Take Two continues.
Grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hand played a tambourine so well. Grandma's hand used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast. Might fall on a piece of glass. Might
could be snakes there in that dress, Grandma's hand.
Grandma's back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. Emmy Martinez. The coronavirus has forced schools everywhere to really reinvent themselves on the fly. School buildings shut down, state leaders say they're unlikely to reopen before summer, and so many are moving to online or distance learning programs. Thing is, though, the shift has been really hard on students with disabilities. There are nearly 250,000 kids receiving special education services in L.A. and Orange counties. Many rely on therapies that schools are not used to offering from afar. Here to explain what the coronavirus means for students with disabilities are two members of KPCC's education team, Carla Javier, who we'll talk to in just a few minutes, and also Kyle Stokes. Carla, Kyle, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Now, okay, Kyle, coronavirus aside, special education is complicated, even normal times. Why is that?
Well, so federal law protects students' right to what's called a free and appropriate public education. And that means that if a student comes in with a recognized disability, the school has to accommodate its services to make sure that that student is able to access that free and appropriate public education. And so every single child, and there are millions across the U.S., 800,000 in California, every child with a recognized disability gets what's called an IEP. It's a federally protected individualized education plan, and it spells out often a list of services that these students are entitled to receive in order to get an equitable education. This can go from being in a special class to receiving special services like speech or physical therapy, occupational therapy, that sort of thing. That's all federally protected, and it's done on an individualized level.
But what are you hearing from parents of special ed kids?
Well, that a lot of these services just aren't happening right now, or at least that they're been being put on pause. For example, I talked to a parent named Allison Rivera. Allison's the mother of a four-year-old son named Joel who has autism, and it was just a whole process to get him identified as being on the autism spectrum in the first place in a way that the school would recognize. But once the school did recognize that he had autism, the Corona-Norco Unified School District, they put him in a special preschool class. He's about to move into kindergarten, and they offered him speech and occupational therapy through the district. And, you know, even before the coronavirus, Allison has been worried about her son falling too far behind both developmentally and academically. And she saw these therapies, speech and occupational therapy, as critical to helping Joel catch up. And they just got access to these services a few months ago. But now the coronavirus has these therapies on pause, both from the school and from private therapists that Joel is seeing. Here's what she said.
You feel this time crunch on you, like, I have to hurry up and get this. And so for me, it was super frustrating to be like, I got everything settled finally. And then this happened, and now we're back to square one, basically.
All right, so Kyle, school districts are obligated to serve students like Allison's son, but the coronavirus has changed that obligation, or has it? I mean, it's an emergency right now, so have they changed it?
This has actually been a real point of confusion. Initially, there was guidance from the federal government that led some school districts around the country, including a handful in California, to conclude that if they couldn't serve students with disabilities equally with students of, you know, general education, where it's a little bit more straightforward of a task to just have students do distance learning online or with a packet sending home, if you couldn't serve them equally, then some school districts concluded they shouldn't serve anyone at all and just not offer any distance learning services. Now, the federal government has since sent out more guidance that has made it clear you are supposed to offer services to these students. You cannot let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And state officials here in California, the state superintendent of public instruction, Tony Thurmond, has emphasized you do have to provide services to students. But I think that what those services look like is still kind of TBD, and the advice from state and federal officials on precisely the details of what that looks like are still kind of forthcoming at this point.
What about delivering those services virtually?
I think that that's what schools are trying to figure out how to do right now. Things like speech therapy, behavioral therapy, physical therapy. Imagine giving physical therapy over Zoom. But a lot of schools are coming forward right now to say, this is something that we can do. I was talking with an occupational therapist. Occupational therapy is a lot about fine motor skills, among other things. And that's a perfect time, this provider says, to raid your kitchen, raid, your home office and find you know, things that can stand in for tools that you might use in the classroom. It's not necessarily expensive or specialized gear. At the same time, navigating this challenge is going to be difficult because educators say, you know, it's not the same. A minute in the real world classroom isn't necessarily the same in a virtual one.
Yeah, all this seems like a lot of change to deal with all at once. Let's turn now to KPCC's Carla Javier, who talked to a special educator about advice she has for families as they navigate classwork as all of this gets figured out. Carla, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks.
All right, so what advice have you rounded up?
Well, so I talked to Angel Gaines. She's been in special education for over 10 years, working with districts, private schools, and families to help students with mild to moderate disabilities. And she teaches these 9th and 10th graders, again, with these mild to moderate disabilities in a special day class at a special education school site. Here's what she told me.
I want parents to not think they have to be a credentialed teacher. You know, you're not a credentialed teacher. We studied this. We went to school. We wrote papers. Like, that's not what we want you to do. What we want you to do is to just facilitate learning.
She also said to find the time of day when their student works best, even if it doesn't follow the like traditional school day. She also recommends being flexible on expectations.
Things being done doesn't always look like every single part of the worksheet or something is filled out. Sometimes it's a drawing. Sometimes it's a discussion. Sometimes it's a movie.
All right, now, so that's her recommendation for parents. What about students? What advice did she have for them?
Yeah, the biggest thing she wanted to tell her students and also students in general was to be patient with themselves and with their families.
Give more effort to show your parents and guardians the things that you are able to do.
She acknowledged that it might be really confusing right now because students might not be used to staying at home like this unless it's vacation. But here's her advice for that.
Try your best to maintain that level of concentration and focus that you were coming to school with. Take your time. Things that are frustrating you or things that seem very, very difficult, save those for the end.
She also wanted to remind students to keep drinking water, to stay healthy, and to keep thinking and dreaming about the future, not just focusing on all this unpredictability that's happening right now.
That's KPCC's Carla Javier. She joined our education reporter, Kyle Stokes. Carla and Kyle will continue to report on how the campus closures are affecting students with special needs. And if you want to share your experiences, you can definitely tweet them. You can find Carla at Carla M. Javier, and Kyle is at KY Stokes. Carla, Kyle, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Wei.
You're welcome.
Now, on the lighter side of living in the age of coronavirus, it's tough to date when you can't meet up or go anywhere. But if you have the will, we have the ways to at least get that dating ball rolling. And even if you hit it off, we'll help you game out how to keep that fire burning until you don't have to keep your physical distance. I mean, that's the point, right? If you meet someone, you like them, you don't want to keep your physical distance. We'll find out all the tips when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes, something without wanting love bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
Now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC, Amy Martinez. The stay-at-home order issued a couple of weeks ago has undoubtedly disrupted many aspects of our lives, including matters of the heart. I'm talking to all my single listeners out there who are in the dating scene and now suddenly find themselves at home and maybe alone. So how do you find love in the time of coronavirus? And if you find it, how do you keep it? For that and more, we have Damona Hoffman. She's the host and producer of the Dates and Mates podcast on love and relationships. Welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So with life in quarantine, how are people dating? How are they figuring that part out?
Believe it or not, A, the dating apps are actually seeing a surge in conversations and new users, and there's actually never been a better time to find love online.
I remember back in the, like a million years ago when I was single, the best part of the whole relationship was that first 2-hour phone call, right? When you're getting to know them because you still haven't built up the pressure to actually going out on a date and meeting. So it seems like, considering that no one can meet right now, it seems like the whole dating scene right now is that initial 2-hour phone call. No pressure because you can't see each other in person.
I agree with you, A. I think that is a magical time. And I've been doing this for 15 years. I started out as a dating profile writer. And I have found that as technology has improved and we've had dating apps and we've had texting has become our primary mode of communication, people have been moving too quickly in dating. And the real connections I find develop when people take the time to get to know each other on a deeper level. So I actually think this could be a really good thing for dating, that it's forcing people to slow down, to really listen, and to connect before they just swipe, 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 go on a date, see what happens.
All right, so let's say someone has taken the leap and they want to start dating. What would be the first step? Take us through that first part.
Well, you have to create a great profile that really draws the right people into you. That's the first step. I find that most people just sort of throw together without much thought, like, oh, here's a cute picture from Instagram. I'll just put that on. And I like to curate the dating profile to say exactly what you're looking for. Now, if you already have a profile, what you've said in your profile may not actually be the right thing for right now. You may have been interested in a serious relationship. Now maybe you're looking for something more casual, but you have to make sure that it's a reflection of what you're really looking for. And I recommend using, I call it the 3 C's to draw in the dates. So it's color, context, and character. Color to really stand out, context to tell what your life story is, what you like doing when you can actually leave your house, and character that's showing your personality. And that's the one that most people miss.
So, okay. So in that process where you're talking about talking and really getting to know someone, what tips do you have in terms of building that rapport over text, over maybe like a FaceTime call, and building toward that eventual next step whenever that happens, whenever the coronavirus allows us to have that face-to-face?
Okay, here's a key tip in my dating strategy. Do not spend too much time over text, especially now that the end goal is not even meeting in person just yet. It's just to move to a video date. You have to get to that point more quickly, because a lot of misunderstanding can happen when you're just sending text back and forth. So get through that within the first few days. I do like the phone call, A, like you mentioned. I don't know about 2 hours. I like a very quick check-in just to make sure that the person aligns with what you thought they were going to be and that it's worth spending time on a video date. And then I suggest scheduling something that is not just like, hey, should we chat now? That's the trap that a lot of people fall into now. And many of the dating apps have chat features, video chat, that's built into the app. So it's really easy to just hit a button and now you're face to face, but you never get a chance to make that first impression again. So it's very important that you're setting yourself up for that first video date the same way you would for an actual face-to-face date.
That 2-hour phone call was on my mom's phone bill, so it was she paid for it. I'm good with that. We're talking to Damona Hoffman, host and producer of the Dates and Mates show, a podcast on love and relationships. All right, so that virtual relationship, though, how do you keep that going? How do you keep romance alive via a device?
There's so many tools now today, but just to get back to communication, that's really at the core of every great relationship. And this is now a time where we can finally escape from the how is your day texts, especially if you send them now. I think we know what the answer is going to be. So let's go a level deeper and get into storytelling and nostalgia and really getting to know that person that you hopefully will get to meet in person. One thing that I use with my clients and that I recommend on my to my podcast listeners is to use callbacks in your text conversation. Reference something that you talked about before. Maybe send a cute GIF that acknowledges the shared experience that you had or something that you discussed before. And that can really build a bond and a rapport between two people.
The thing is, Damona, patience and thinking about the long game is very tough when you're lonely.
It's true. It's true. But we're all in this situation right now. So just take it moment to moment. Take it one day at a time and really focus on finding connection.
Damona Hoffman is the host and producer of the Dates and Mates Show, a podcast on love and relationships. Damona, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My friend. Feel it's their appointed duty. They keep trying to tell me, all you want to do is use me. But my answer, they don't all that use me stuff.
Finally, if you need to stretch those muscles from being inside too long, we have advice on how to get a workout while still being inside.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran and Anne Martinez. We're all in need of this ability to move around, right?
Yeah.
So for this weekend, I suggest that people have what I've always been calling a PDP, a personal dance party.
All right, while I stretch, tell us, how do you get one started?
Well, by creating a playlist that features some great music. So I reached out to some of our favorite music experts, Oliver Wang and Morgan Rose.
Nice.
Yeah, so first I asked them each for a newer song or album to get the party started. And Oliver recommended this.
Good morning. Wake up, wake. Wake up, wake. Wake up and get yourself to church.
Ooh, I love the build-up. It's like a nice little warm-up build-up, and then it goes banging. Who is this?
Yeah, this is Sam Henshaw featuring Earth Gang, and it's their song called Church. I thought it really resembled the positive, upbeat aura that I usually get from similar artists like Chance the Rapper. And Oliver picked this song for that very reason.
It has just that feeling of uplift and the ways in which the choir tradition in gospel music is about praise, and it's about inspiration. It's about being filled with spirit. And I think we can all use a little bit of an injection of uplift and spark in our life.
And I can't stress enough, Leo, how a song building up, oof, that is a great workout kind of thing. Okay, so then Morgan Rhodes shared her pick. What's her pick?
Someone who's heavily in rotation in my own home, Kay Tronada. So Kay Tronada is this DJ, and his album Bubba came out last year. He's got some really great partners on it, like Pharrell and Charlotte Day Wilson. This song is Taste, featuring Van Jess. And Morgan said his music really takes you into that hip LA club where you can both groove and be chill. And it's kind of nice to imagine we'll be able to do that again soon.
I think what Kay Tronada does with his music is he makes you comfortable on the dance floor. So if all you have is a sort of a reserve two-step, it's all good with Kay Tronada. If you're into like complicated dance geometry and theatrics, also all good with Kay Tronada.
By the way, for the listeners who have wondered what Leo Duran is like, that song Taste by Kay Tronada, that is Leo Duran to a T. let it wash over you.
Okay, thanks, A. I've never felt so cool.
It's true. It's absolutely true. Now, okay, so you asked also for both of them to suggest some classic songs to dance to. Why?
Well, because we're all in need of some comfort, too. And songs from our past can help take us back to basically when times were simpler. So kicking it off, Oliver Wang suggested something from over 50 years ago. This is the song Micaela by Pete Rodriguez. And Oliver points out that young people, especially, probably know him best because Cardi B sampled his other song, I Like It Like That.
That's what I was thinking, too. I'm one of those young people, Leo. That's what I was thinking.
Okay, but Oliver says the whole album is great because
almost every track on here just grooves. And the thing about Latin Boogaloo in particular, and really just Latin dance music in general, is that this is music that has been refined over many years through hundreds of different artists with the express purpose of getting people to dance.
And plus, you really have to have a heart of stone not to be able to move to any Latin music. That's just the way it's constructed. It's absolutely the way it's constructed. All right, so finally, what's the classic pick by Morgan Rhodes?
Well, you and I both grew up in the 90s, so I think this one will get us grooving. Obviously, this is a remix of Mary J. Blige's Real Love, featuring the Notorious B.I.G. before he hit it big.
I mean, and he got in and out of that thing. Like, but the impression that he left was fire. And this is a year before, you know, his debut album would come out. Look up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. Nope, it's Mary J. Ain't a damn thing changed. It's got everything that you need. It's dancey, it's got the chunky beats, it's got Mary, it's got a bar. It is a quintessential 90s album.
Okay, so now that people have songs to get the party started, here's my suggestion of what you do this weekend. Fire up your preferred streaming music player, like Spotify or Google Play Music or Pandora, then ask it to start a mix based on one of these songs, and then just dance until you wear a hole into the rug. And if you want more music suggestions, check out Oliver Wang and Morgan Rhodes on their own music podcast, Heat Rocks. Plus, you can find me on Twitter, at Leo Has a Cat.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, dance off.
Have a great weekend, eh?
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two today or any other parts of the week, I mean, there was some good stuff all week long. Just find us wherever you find your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media. We're on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. And there you can find me as well at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. And that's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.